and welcome to AMO Kenzoku, episode 49. We are a group of four Bubblegum Crisis Boomer Otaku who wanted an excuse to talk about anime, manga, and any related subjects we find interesting. The Kenzoku are...
Hey y'all, I'm Mike.
Hello, hello, I'm Nick.
Hi, this is Dylan.
And I'm your host for the evening, Sam. This episode is being recorded on March 28th, 2024, and we will be discussing the anime Shin Sekaiori from the New World with spoilers galore. With that, let's get started. Hashin! And before we get into the main topic, we had a couple of kind of appetizers here we wanted to talk about. Dylan, you wanted to talk a little bit about FF Rebirth and End of Eva.
Yeah. Also, quick thing, this is episode 48, but...
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Correct. It's 48.
48.
Yeah. I've been playing Final Fantasy VII Rebirth, the second in the trilogy. I think it's going to be Remake and then Rebirth, and then I think the third one is Reunion. So I loved Final Fantasy VII Remake. I think I started replaying it again before Rebirth came out. I didn't quite get all the way through, but that's okay. It was like my fourth or fifth time playing it through. Like, I think it might be like the best modern Final Fantasy. And Rebirth is, I think it's really good, but it's so wild because Final Fantasy VII Remake was this, it was just the ultimate... in some ways, like, the ultimate Final Fantasy, like, so super linear, clean, like, well done. You just, like, you got on the train at the beginning of the game, literally, and you just never got off the whole game. And you just go through this, you know, really great 35-hour story, and it's just, like, super focused. Whereas Rebirth, it still has story stuff, and I've... frankly, I haven't gotten very far in the actual story part, I think, but it is a huge open world game, you know, with all of the trappings of open world game stuff, which is such a crazy difference. Like, there was a few there's some, like, quests and things and stuff to do in Remake, but it was very few. It was very limited. It was like you go into an area and be like, oh, there's like five little things to do and they're pretty quick. And you're like, okay, cool. That was kind of a fun little thing. Or you could skip them and be fine. But this game is all about doing all these things and collecting them all and finding these towers and finding all the different things and going around and exploring the world. And it's like, it is gorgeous. The loading times for everything are really great. They've done the best job that they have yet to do with chocobo riding, because they finally got it to where they kind of took the way it worked in Final Fantasy 15, which was really greatly done, where you call the chocobo and it kind of rides up behind you, so you kind of just don't see it and hop on. But they made it such that it's super smooth to hop on and off once you've got it there. But I just find it so interesting that it's, you go from this super linear thing to out to this very open world, which kind of makes sense with what the original game did at that point, where Remake takes place entirely inside of the Midgar portion, and then where Rebirth picks off is right after you leave, and you end up in the open world, in the outer world. So that it was, I found it very interesting there. And I, you know, if you want an open world game, I'd be hard pressed to find one that has been better executed and looks better. There's others that are really good too. Like, I think, the samurai
Ghost of one. Tsushima.
Yeah. Ghost of Tsushima. That game is awesome and did so many things incredibly well. So, yeah, that's kind of my thoughts. I don't know if anyone else has played any of Rebirth or not, but that's kind of my first impression, which I was like, huh, very interesting that it's so different that way.
I personally have not played any of Rebirth yet. I haven't even purchased it because I just knew I don't want to, like, have it steal my life because I'm about to go to Japan and I need to focus on that. Also, I still need to get through Intergrid, so I wanted to play through that before I went through Rebirth. But original FF7 Remake was like my game of the year for 2019 when it came out.
Yep, same here.
Amazing game. I mean, can't really find too many flaws in it. I think it did everything it needed to do really well. So I'm super excited to play Rebirth. And yeah, I've managed to avoid anything spoilery whatsoever. I've seen a few pictures here and there that are like, okay, yeah, that's not a big deal. But yeah, good to hear that it does the open world thing well. Open world stuff's usually not my thing, but you know, I'm not like vehemently against it if it's done well. So good to hear that it's doing it very, very well so far. And yeah, I'll probably get to it maybe mid part of the year.
I've heard, I haven't played it yet either. But I have heard some stuff about the open world things, but I will refrain from bringing secondhand criticism lest I taint your opinion.
Mm. Yeah.
I've occasionally been watching a streamer play some of it, and the open world stuff looks really cool, as just the whole look of the game is pretty nice as someone who doesn't have a PS5, so don't have a lot to compare it with.
I could be wrong. I think it's done in the new Unreal Engine 5.
Mm-hmm.
And it's crazy. These engines and everything they have nowadays, these days, just like the render and the draw distance and the crazy low, there's like no load times for, you know, it doesn't even seem like anything. There's hardly any, you know, for such this huge, massive world, there's like nearly none of the, elevator loading or pinch walks. There's very few of those at all.
Oh, that's nice. That yeah. was a big complaint I had about 16, is that you still had that. I'm assuming that was because of the PC release, but that was very aggravating.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a couple of them once in a while, but it's very few and far between. You're not just like, oh, every 30 seconds I'm going through a pinch walk to let this next area load. So I recommend it. The combat's cool. One of the other things that I definitely like about it is they've also expanded the people that you can play with, and they continue to have them, the ones that were in Remake, play very pretty much the same way as they did, a little bit different, but very similar, and the new individuals that get added have their own different combat styles, which makes it really fun, because then you get to mix up your team and set stuff up such you get different combat styles and people that you try to play with in different ways, which is pretty cool.
It looks cool. Like it is Unreal 4 still.
It isn't, huh? But, well, hell, that's a good engine too.
I mean, Unreal 4 is bulletproof for a real long time, so I'm assuming when the dev cycle started, Unreal 4 was still kind of the main one, so I wouldn't be shocked if the third one was pivoted to 5 just for extra oomph. But
yeah,
no. On the other hand, that, you know, if it's working for them, and they've got all this, their pipelines built up around 4, probably maybe they can pull other stuff in or something like that.
So my next thing is on End of Eva, which I saw in the theater, and there was a lot of showings here in Buffalo, which is awesome. It looks like there are a lot more other places. It was the theatrical event of the season. I was super excited for it, and man, I haven't watched that movie in a little while, and seeing it on the big screen, like, my opinion is that it's the best movie of the 90s. Without a question, I'm just like, it's the best movie of the 90s. It is the most insane art house movie that's ever been made and is great and has, you know, it's just this ultimate anime, because there's, you know, I'm in the Eva well now, but it's like... You know, I just seeing it the way you're just like, what the hell? Like, hey, here's a movie where, what do you have? Oh, well, you have a robot that's a tree of life that goes into the clitoris that's on the head of a giant being. You're like,
yeah, you know, which is funny, because I think I mentioned this in Discord, because I had only watching this, because I also went to it in the theater. This is only the second time I'd ever seen it. And the first time I saw it without subtitles off of a recording from Japanese TV that my exchange student gave me in high school, and I did not understand a lot of the stuff in there, including the imagery. I was like, oh, this time it was way different.
Yeah. It's incredible. It has my favorite animation fight sequence in anything ever of EVA 02 versus the EVA series.
It's my all-timer, right?
Seeing it on that scale on a screen was just like, I was losing it. So, you know, it's there's a reason why EVA is so well regarded. And I'm going to go ahead and say, nope, you can't, back to our very early episodes, and be like, nope, you can't just not watch TV anymore. You still have to watch it, because it's not just because of that, but if it were only just to watch End of EVA, I would say that alone is worth the price of watching TV versus the new movies. That's my opinion of the movie.
Yeah. It was awesome. It was, I need to watch TV again, because it was kind of jarring, I guess, that I had forgotten how it just kind of picks up at, what is it, like at 24, 25 or something
Yeah, directly after episode 24.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I binged through all of EVA TV before the movie.
It's mainlined it.
Oh, I mainlined it. It was coming in fresh.
I can't say I can automatically disagree with your statement, Dylan. EOE is way up there in my ratings. It is really, really phenomenal. And I totally agree. I think I there's no way you can have rebuilds truly replace TV. I think I truly think of them as like a, you know, a companion to it. I enjoy both a lot, but yeah, I didn't get an opportunity to get to the theatrical showings, but I can only imagine how glorious the Asuka comeback fight against the whole world basically was. I mean,
The one thing you can't do in a theater, though, is pause the walls of text.
Yeah, but you're also kind of, you know, the whole, it is, I mean, I can just go on the EVA well for another five episodes without stopping, but you're also not meant to.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it was still fun that time we did.
Oh, I don't remember that. My memory's terrible.
I feel like it was on your projector at Ben's house.
Ah, that's quite possible. So, anyways, that's my ranting on I Love EVA. And it's great. And it's an infinite well.
Yes, it won't be the last time we discuss EVA on this podcast.
No, definitely not. And with that, I'll
which means
my
it was probably literally 20 years ago, which is making my brain explode. But other than that, I think you're forgiven for not remembering that, Dylan.
Yeah, thank you.
I did remember it, and so I had two other quick things I wanted to mention. One is, the first is that I went to another anime movie showing. I went to the double feature of the movies, the latest two movies for the Rascal Does Not Dream of Bunny Girl Senpai, which is a terrible title. It makes it sound much worse than it is. But that was really cool to see in the theater. The it was a Fathom thing, and for some reason, like, they had to like reboot the computer that was showing the movie, and it didn't start till like a half hour later. But it was fine. It just meant we missed previews. It was very interesting. But that series is super cool. I recommend everybody go watch it.
Yeah, I've been wanting to watch it for a while.
Maybe we stick that on our future list.
Yeah, it's on CR. And the other thing that I really wanted to mention is I started getting a little bit of FOMO after finding some stuff that I wanted to buy was like out of stock and like out of print. And so like I went over to Crunchyroll, formerly Write Stuff, to go try and buy some stuff while I still could. Mainly, I wanted to get Konosuba. I figured once season 3 comes out, there's going to be a run on them. And their store is massively screwed up right now.
Yep.
I think they just switched over to a thing, and I didn't realize this until after I tried to buy stuff. But I bought stuff earlier yesterday, I think. I bought Konosuba seasons 1 and 2. And the order goes through, and I never get my confirmation email. My credit card wasn't charged. I'm still not sure what's up with that order. And I did it again today with, of course, more stuff because I found more things. And the same thing happened. I see that in my order history, though, the credit card info in my order history is wrong. Like, the expiration date is wrong. This is a Visa, but it should be a MasterCard. The last four digits are wrong. And then they send me an email like half hour later that says, hey, you haven't finished your order. And and there's a button to click to go to finish, to quote unquote, finish my order. And I click it, and it takes me, says, to the site, and it says, your card is empty. I'm like, what is going on?
Oh, man.
So I fear that I'm going to get charged. I don't know what is going on. It's weird because, I mean, RightStuff has been doing this stuff forever, and ostensibly they should be responsible for this. So I don't know. It's weird. But I hope they figure it out, because yeah, I'd like to get my stuff. I really wanted to get the Monogatari series, too. Those are very expensive, and I hope I don't get like charged double for those things.
Oh, ouch.
But we'll see.
And don't forget that you can also get a copy of Elhazard the Wanderer's collection for $23.71. That's $23.71 you'll never have back.
Yeah, I will not be doing that.
Yeah, I still haven't watched my Pioneer DVDs that I got of that back in the Genion, like, implosion sale, so I don't need to rebuy that one.
All right, so with that, that's enough of that. Let's go on to our real topic this evening, which is Shin Sekaiori from the New World. A little bit of quick background info. So this is a TV anime. It was a 25-episode TV anime that ran from October 3rd, 2012 to March 26, 2013. So like 12 years ago, I think, which is crazy to think about. Animated by A1 Pictures, directed by Masashi Ishihama, and series composition by Masashi Sogo. I didn't quite get around to looking through what other stuff those guys have done. The series is based on a novel published by Yusuke Kishi that was published in 2008. It's not available in English, but they Vertigo brought over another of his novels in 2006 called The Crimson Labyrinth. There are no ebook versions that I could find, but you can still buy a paperback version of the book at bookstores. This guy is also apparently pretty successful in Japan, the novelist. He's written over 10 novels, and I think all of them have either been nominated for or won awards. So this guy's kind of a big deal, and I think it shows in the series itself. Does anybody want to try and give a brief summary of what the series is about?
I guess I'll fall on that sword. I like how you already had me in mind. I'll take a stab at it. I'm really bad at I'm usually long form, but I'll try to keep it as succinct as possible. It's basically 5,000 years in the future. Is that about right?
1,000.
1,000? Okay. 1,000 years into the future from what we would call the current era of man. Basically, it focuses on a group of children, five children in Japan, who seem to be, you know, all close friends, and you find out that they go to a school where all the children have various forms of telepathic and telekinetic powers. I guess more telekinetic than telepathic. Anyway, they have psycho powers, and that seems to be heavily normalized. Until we find out that the history of why it seems like everybody has these powers is actually because at one point a small number of individuals on Earth have started developing these powers, and a handful of them started to go on murderous rampages, and it basically began an apocalyptic event on Earth where those with powers and those without powers were basically violently at war with each other until one faction finally one, and it was, of course, the faction of telepaths, because they have powers that are super impossible for normal humans and normal human weaponry to fight. And so that's the when the kids find that out, it kind of cascades into this chain of events. That
the show doesn't tell you this stuff until you kind of figure it out.
Yeah, I'm telling it more in chronological order, but you don't find this out chronologically. Meanwhile, the children get kind of lost and almost kidnapped by a group of giant mutant rats that turns out to be kind of the grunt work enforcers for humankind, because one of the safety measures that was taken for these telepaths is they've been genetically modified so that they cannot use their powers to attack other humans. So if they need to, you know, get rid of a person, they use these rats as kind of the executioners. And then a whole lot of stuff happens. Time goes on. Kids...
There are, what, three time jumps or so?
Technically three, because the very, very end there's a big one. Technically three. But you basically find out that society is still rigged and run by those, you know, who have the air quotes most power. The giant mutant rats don't really like the fact that they are indentured servants to the humans and start a series of actions that basically start almost another catastrophic event, which our plucky main characters are able to stop. I think I'll stop there because I'm going to keep going for about 35 more minutes this is a very long form show. I think Sam put it best. Mm-hmm. It's a very slow burn. So it's almost impossible to succinctly like give a synopsis of it, in my opinion. It's probably one of the hardest shows to give like a succinct synopsis of, and honestly.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So one of the things I thought was interesting about the show from the beginning was the animation quality is quite high.
Really?
I think so, yeah.
I think it
sags, certainly, but like I thought it was done pretty well.
I think it started good, and then somewhere around Ep 6 through, like, 10, it got really, in my opinion, weird and bad. Like, it seemed like they decided that, like, it could just be me, but there were cuts that looked like they didn't like the look of the whole scene, so instead they zoomed in and cropped out parts of it. To make that the cut, because certain parts I was like, whoa, I'm seeing detail that I shouldn't be seeing, like errors in the art almost. So it's kind of how I thought of it. So
I'm glad you bring up that, because in particular, I noticed that I first saw comments in the Crunchyroll about episode 5. And they were complaining, and I was like, what's this about? And I saw it, and I was like, the animation actually looks fine, but like you say, it was zoomed in real tight on a lot of it. But I think it was still animated well in that. And then after that episode, it kind of goes back to quote-unquote normal.
It does. It was about four episodes. It was kind of that first arc with the rats, I felt like, was all done kind of weird.
I don't think so, and I'll tell you why in a second. Episode 10, it goes back, and I noticed that. And so I went looking, like, what is it with these two episodes, 5 and 10 in particular? And there are two people, the episode director Shigeyasu Yamauchi and animation director Junichi Hayama. These two dudes are the ones responsible for those two episodes, and those like they didn't do anything else other than those two episodes, so it kind of lines up. And I found that out from Random Curiosity, if anybody remembers that site from back in the day, a dude who blogs about like every anime episode he ever watches. And then, you know, confirmed by ANN. So like there was definitely something particular about those two episodes. I think any other peculiarities were maybe some different things, but that was a weird style that they had of going in real tight. And I I'm not sure I like it.
I did not.
It sounds like you didn't either.
No, those two episodes definitely felt weird just in pacing and plot too. There was kind of a lot of weird. It felt weird, just best way to put it.
Yeah.
A couple of scenes where there was no, I think it's like episode five, there was a scene where I was like, ooh, this is like kind of a breaking point for me, guys. You better stop or I'm going to just not watch all of this. And
you're talking about that touchy-feely stuff?
Yeah. Like the whole, oh, they've been genetically encoded to be like bonobos. I'm like, really? That's kind of weird to put it in there, but whatever. And then I was like, oh, no, don't do that. Please, no. And then they didn't, so I was like, okay, I'll keep watching. And then they definitely eased off that for a while, and then they slammed back on the accelerator for about three episodes, and then they backed off for the rest of the show, so I was okay with it. But, yeah.
That part was weird in particular. Like, I didn't really like that.
Especially
angle,
because
it felt gratuitous.
Yeah, and also because, like, they're 12, so.
Yeah, yes, especially that. I was feeling really, awkward, like,
there
was some stuff later that I thought was pretty cool animation wise episode 18, this is when the attack from the monster rats, the Bakenizu, on the village happens, and like I noticed when the that, I don't know what you would call that, like, tower they had erected in the center of
Basically like a watchtower, right? The giant watchtower looking thing. Yeah.
When that thing blows up, I was like, this looks very Trigger, but I couldn't find any Trigger person responsible for that. But I thought that was really cool. I don't know if anybody else noticed any interesting animation that stood out to them.
There's the whole thing, like, I agree. There's so much weird production stuff in it. Masashi Ishihama, the director, he's been a key animator for a long time, going back to late 80s, early 90s, a key animator for like Devil Hunter Yoko, Bubblegum Crash, tons of stuff throughout the 90s. He was a key animator for a couple episodes of Kari Kano. What other stuff? He directed Horimiya. I never saw that, but it's
a good one. Recommended.
Key animator on Jinro. So that wasn't animated well or anything. Read or Die TV. He's the character. He was the character designer and OVA character for both of them. Character designer, chief animation director for both. He's done and Space Girl, Starship Girl, Yamamoto Yoko, both OVAs.
Whoa, oh, nice. That's a deep cut in this group. Nice.
Yeah. So he's definitely someone who has some, you know, very deep animation chops and stuff. And I think it was one of the cool things I think that did show up where, like, I agree, there's some parts where you're like, yeah, the animation is like not good and it's weird here. And then you go to other episodes and segments and you're like, well, this is a little weird, but it's really cool and like interestingly done. And I'm like, okay, like that's cool at least. Taking an aside from that, here's the thing that I found was kind of weird. It was like the whole thing where they don't have an opening song.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
And they have the different titles and stuff. As I was watching it, it felt to me it was like, huh, well, this made the thing that should be kind of like, oh, a special thing or something like that, and it just made it like not special.
I feel like that choice was because that's what a lot of J dramas are and were like. Is they just cut in with like, you know, the first like impactful opening scene, and then just you see the title. Hit in the name of the episode, and that's it. And I think that's what they're trying to maybe go for, because this is a very drama-like show in its pacing. Very, very slow.
Yeah.
Very plotting. A lot of angles and you know, romantic tensions and things happening. I will say, I would have liked to have seen an opening, only because this is pretty early in the A1 days, right? Like, this was made in, like, what, 2012?
Yeah.
So relatively early, when you know, in A1 as like a established studio, obviously A1 is made by a ton of veterans, but I did enjoy the first ending a lot. I thought that was... love the song and the animation and everything. It was super cool, and it kind of alludes to a lot of the things, like, in these clips. And I was like, okay. When I saw it, I'm like, hey, you know, the show has a hot ending. I can at least stick with it for a few episodes. F5 was almost a deal breaker, and then I got through it, and then it was okay. And then I can just say, I guess I'll be the first to say, if I had to, you know, judge this show on a binary system of did I like it or not, I guess I can say that I liked it. I'm definitely glad I watched it, because I was definitely invested by the end, but geez, there was a lot of build up to that. Like, holy moly.
Yeah, it's one where I'm like, because the second time jump doesn't happen to like ep 16. And I'm kind of like, well, what was the point? It's almost like, what was the point of, you have the first bit where they're 12 or whatever, and then you have the part where Sheen loses his mind. That's one episode. And then there's no point of anything else that was almost until that second time jump. Like, I guess you could have the part where the two people absconded into the wilderness.
Mamoru and
there's so much. As I was watching it, I don't think I realized at the time that it was from a novel, but I'm like, as I was watching it, I'm like, this really feels like this would work very well as like a novel.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I was like, I'm just not sure that it works well as an anime. But I'm like, as I was watching, I'm like, oh, this seems like this would be a good novel. And I went to Wiki, I'm like, oh, it's from a novel. Okay, that makes a lot more sense.
Yeah.
Well, what is it in particular that makes it feel like not great for anime but better for novel?
For me, I think it was kind of in the way the different cuts and the way that they kind of explained and didn't explain stuff at the same time. And it just felt very much like, it's hard to say, like, it just kind of felt like, oh, if I was reading this, I think it might kind of like make more sense, or they might fill in some more of these other little parts and things. Because it's definitely a show that felt like there was so many of these different threads and things and stuff out there, and they just like drop so many of them and like never.
Yeah, like you've got those flashbacks at the beginning of the first, especially the first few episodes, that you have no real idea what's going on until you've already watched the show once.
Well, I mean, I would say that's a positive, not a negative, right? Like,
yeah.
And I would say that that's the benefit of it being.
Yeah, the show does have some rewatch value. I'll say that for it, because there's a lot that you catch on a second viewing.
Yeah. I think that's the benefit of having something like a novel being the material, because a lot of times when you have anime that's either original or based on manga, just the nature of how those things are created means that it's pretty rare for a creator to have fully thought through their story to a point that they could plant seeds early that then bloom later. You have the typical thing, right, where it's like an episode will start, and then there'll be a flashback at the start of the episode giving you background to something that will happen in the second half of the episode, which just feels like a big cheat. Whereas in this one, like, who is the other kid? One of them can make, in the very early days when they're kids, you see him making like mirrors and stuff, like practicing this in class, and it's like he's good at this. Oh, and then this comes up much later in
Satoru,
the series.
Right? It comes up in, that's like his main Satoru, thing, like his for recon, right? He makes mirrors for recon. Yeah. True. I do agree. They set up a lot of these seemingly inconsequential things, and it's not like all of them even become major things, but they call back to them, which I definitely appreciated. I think the main thing that I appreciated probably after watching it all and thinking about it was how organically they built Saki and Satoru's relationship across quite literally the entire show. Like, that was the slowest of burns, and you weren't even sure it was going to be a thing, because by the time they're like working adults, like, they hadn't seen each other in a while, they're kind of, you know, she's kind of standoffish to him, and then they go through the final events where obviously, you know, more trauma and working together and all that. And then at the end, they, you know, they're really the only two left in their original group. So
oh, yeah, that's true. Yeah. I don't know about you guys, but I think it sounds like maybe you guys are a little similar, but I had some trouble sticking with it early on. And I kind of had to force myself to do it in kind of chunks. But there were parts where I really felt engaged, especially in when the rat people, the monster rats basically raid the town. Like that whole section was really intense to me. I really mm-hmm. thought that was done pretty well. I don't know how you guys felt about that.
Totally agree. Really difficult. I would say for me personally, shotgunning like 4 to 6 episodes at a time was actually what got me through watching the show initially. Mm-hmm. I would say getting through like ep 16 was challenging for me. And then I started to get more and more invested into it after that, so I could watch it a bit more episodically from there. But yeah, everything with the giant monster rats was interesting. I was at first initially kind of disappointed that became the main actual real conflict at the end, until I saw all the working parts behind it, and then I kind of bought into it more. Especially once they revealed like the final MacGuffin of like how because the entire show, right, you see like literally one child can more or less level an entire colony of rats, right? Because they're powerless, mm-hmm. and you know, especially a relatively competent, you know, telepath can, you know, basically level them all. And then the whole master plan for Squeeda, whatever his Japanese name, Yakomaru, right? That's his slave name, right, as he called it. And you see what his plan was and what he did, and then like when you first see the ogre, right, and you're like, uh-oh, and then you realize what they actually did to Maria and Mamuru, and you're like, oh, that's really messed up. Because there was that scene in the council where like it can't be them because we've confirmed with DNA and dental records that it was their bodies. I'm like, say what now? So
yeah,
you know, I was like, yeah. Oh, so that was like a cool and really brutal, like, you know, show don't tell moment. Like, oh man, that sucks. Like you thought they happily ever after and they kind of did, but not really. And then
yeah,
they find out that's what, then they weaponize their daughter. And I'm like, oh dang. Wow. That's really twisted and executed. Actually afterwards I thought, wow, that was executed really well, actually. As brutal as it was, obviously. That was the last few episodes were utterly savage, honestly. Just, and this is a pretty violent show to begin with.
So with that and the not ogre, I still don't understand how Saki like defeated the ogre. It was just felt like such an, to me, the way I watched it, I don't know, it just felt like so anticlimactic or anything. It was just kind of like, oh, well, I didn't do anything. She just died. Did I miss? Well, what did I miss?
So
they had her kill the general rat that was on their side without realizing that that's what she was doing until the reveal, at which point the death of shame got her. Because she had been brought up to believe she was a monster rat, but she still had that DNA in her to prevent her from killing her own kind, which she saw as the rats as opposed to the humans, which is why she could kill the humans.
Oh.
Because
it turned out
she was not an ogre. They were thinking the whole time, it's an ogre because she can kill humans. So it's like, no, she was raised to be a rat, basically. So she thinks that she's a monster rat. So when she kills humans, psychologically it doesn't trigger that genetic marker where they set in, where, you know, the death of shame, as they called it.
Yeah.
But as soon as she kills Kiromaru, who's basically human sized, and dress him like a human, so that's why how they bait her basically into blowing a hole through him, and then he unravels his head and sneers, and then she realizes what happened, and then that's when the genes kick in and she just dies, keels over and dies. So it was initially I thought it was kind of lame, but then I was like, but how else would they really have killed her after? Although I will say the one thing about this show that almost ruined it for me, and it's a silly reason, is the name of the air quotes super weapon they were going to use to stop her was the Psycho Buster. I'm like, oh, was this written by a high schooler? Are you kidding me? And yeah, I know. What I will say about this show is, again, this kind of scratches more of my scientific itch, is they do a few things that are actually pretty clever and believable. Like, it's basically a mutated anthrax, you know, mm-hmm. a spore that, you know, can, that is super virulent and, you know, basically will wipe out a city if you unleash it. And so that's why you're only supposed to use it in those circumstances, because it'll take about a decade to recover for that area to not be like super dangerous. So I'm like, oh, that's actually smart. Mm-hmm. And then the other thing is fast forwarding all the way towards actually not the end, but one thing I thought that was super cool and I thought made a lot of sense was the way they cultivate the monster rats was not through rats, but actually naked mole rats. And that seemed like a really specific thing. And then I thought to myself, oh no, it makes sense. Because one of the main things about these, their psychic powers they talk about, right, is like the leakage of the power actually like warps and mutates all other life around them, unless you have the barrier, right? So that's why everybody lives in the barrier, because otherwise if you live outside, everything else, the only thing that isn't affected by it is the monster rats. And they didn't really even talk about it much, but the main reason that actually kind of makes sense is in real world, naked mole rats are a really bizarre creature in nature. They actually are one of the only known, I believe they are the only known mammal to not be able to get cancer. They have their telomeres actually are perpetually self-repairing, so their telomeres don't shorten when they're, you know, growing and aging. So they actually like hit maturity and then basically don't age until they die.
Oh.
They're a really interesting creature genetically, and obviously scientists are starting to figure out how do we become more like bees, because no cancer seems pretty cool. And so the whole concept of turning, you know, using their, you know, crazy human magic to turn them into these pseudo-human soldier, turns out basically half human soldiers, right? Because they were using human, mm-hmm. you know, DNA mixed it with mole rats. But that concept of how the mole rat colonies can survive outside of the barrier is, it makes sense, because they can't, they're basically immune to the psychic leakage.
So that's
I thought that was pretty rad.
That's cool. Yeah, I agree. Psycho Buster, I was like, what? Come on. You've been better than this the whole time.
Yeah, I was happy that it was actually just, like, you know, an anthrax, like,
yeah,
in a vial. Because if it was some sort of weird, like, laser gun, I would be like, ah, I'm done.
Yeah.
Well, the thing you said there with the mole rats and stuff, because I thought, you know, Square's his final thing is he's like, which was pretty brutal. He's like, we're humans! And, like, everyone's like, ha, 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 you subhuman scum. Now we're going to make you burn in as a pain, gelatinous pain cube forever.
Just how vicious the humans were in this to anything they didn't see as human was interesting.
Well, I feel like the message was, you know, history did repeat itself. It's just, instead of humans against humans, humans made basically something they thought was beneath human, and then they could justify treating it, you know.
But that's what I was trying to figure, because it sounded like that it wasn't that they were not human, but that the colonies, I'll call it, that they were the rest of the humans, but that they were the humans that did not have the psychic mutation, and that they got, and that the psychic people, like, genetically engineered them to effectively, like, look less human. That's what I got out of it. Did I miss something?
I thought that was what they did so that they could kill them without suffering the death of shame, which was how they controlled them.
I think also the reason why they needed them to mutate, because since these telepaths were engineered to not be able to attack other humans, if other humans were allowed to exist, the wars would start. So that's why they mutated them with the mole rat DNA, so that effectively, psychologically, they were no longer considered human. So now that's why they kept them in check, because the mole rats called the people gods, right? Kamisama, because they had the powers and the mole rats didn't.
That's such a weird thing that the death of shame thing was. Because I totally missed on that's what got the not ogre, but that the Death of Shame is then like psychologically based, not genetic. It's not like it's actually, oh, you killed a human and your genes go crazy. It's this psychological conditioning thing, which goes in with the whole rest of the society, which is so, it seems so weird, but then you're like, well, yeah, you know, we do plenty of weird things. Maybe not to just a level of
damaging the things they're afraid of are, you can at least start to understand it a little more, even though you definitely don't condone it.
Yeah. But
so
humans being how humans are, they definitely act like, I could see most of their steps at least making some sense to them at the time.
So I think most of the major plot stuff I eventually got on board with. The one thing that I really couldn't, and it still bugs me, is what purpose did the, let's call it, after Shun really have? Because is he really just a figment of Saki's imagination? Because they make you think that, oh, he actually is around still, and he wasn't. It was literally some sort of fever dream of Saki's the whole time, is what I got out of it.
Yeah, I really hated that part.
Yeah.
About it, because
his whole story before that was beautiful. Like, he was the talented one, but he had the problem where he couldn't control the leakage, and so eventually he would destroy everything, so he had to banish himself, and he, you know, was basically banished, and then eventually, you know, had to kill himself because to save everybody. And I thought that was a very, like, you know, beautiful sacrifice, and it was really tragic that's when you found out afterwards that the society intentionally, you know, erases everybody's memories of those who no longer are around so that they can continue to, you know, as they have for the last 1,000 years. And it's like, damn, that's really messed up and sad. And, like, you know, they almost have the breakthroughs where, like, I remember this kid, but it wasn't this other guy that we were hanging out with. And I'm just like, oh, come on, you can do it. And then you're led to believe something is actually going to come of it, and then it's just like, nope, he was a figment of her imagination the whole time. Like, I don't know, I didn't get that at the end, really.
Oh, I totally didn't pick up that he never actually existed.
Yeah, I'm not so sure on that interpretation.
Well, I don't think Nick is saying that he never existed.
I'm saying that, like,
but that his Force Ghost equivalent was
like, what purpose did it really serve other than to be like a I just don't understand what it served for that. Like, I feel like the whole, his Force Ghost could have not existed, and the story could have continued as is, and it would have been fine.
Yep.
Is, I guess, my thing. Like, what purpose did having Shun come back for that period really serve?
I agree that I don't see really any purpose. But I guess you could maybe say that it is a, it is her, it's like representing her memory recovery of, like, oh, I remember this guy and he keeps coming back in my memory, and, like, I don't know, and it's jogging my memory. I don't know. I can't, it's really hard for me to justify because it does seem really pointless. She could have done both of those things without the weird hallucination ghost, which I also don't feel like they sold it to me enough that he was real. Like, I lean towards Nick's interpretation.
Yeah, I guess my main gripe is just the imaginary Shun didn't really do anything that would have affected the end result, I guess, really, at the end. That's my main thing.
Yeah, yeah. It could have deleted those lines and about him and just had her coming up with the ideas.
Yeah.
And it would have been the same exactly. Yeah. Does anybody, this is like getting really detailed here, but I don't remember if they resolved if Kiro Maru was ever betraying them, because they seem to confront him, but I don't seem to remember him ever being like, oh yeah, I'm just been leading you around like that. I don't, because eventually he like sacrificed himself for them. So like, what happened with that? Nobody remembers anything about that.
Yeah, sorry. I don't know.
Trying to piece it together in my brain.
Because
that one is complicated to try and explain.
Because it seemed like when he was helping them to escape or something, that it was like that Kiro Maru and Squiara, like that they were like already in cahoots and working together to get everything set up. And then, like, at the end, it seems like Kiromaru kind of, like, and I have trouble remembering everything here because I binged Eva after I watched this show, so that will give anyone problems. But then it seemed, at the end, like, Kiromaru, like, kind of betrayed, at that point, then Yakomaru.
I don't think Kiromaru ever fully betrayed. I think there were points where he was contemplating it, but I don't think he ever did, because at the end, he was very honest with him. He's like, you know, how could I, you know, it's foolhardy to think that I would happily, you know, bend my knee to you for all time. Like, when they asked, you know, finally asked, hey, why did you really come out here with your because, you know, he had experience coming out to the wasteland, right, of Tokyo. And he's like, oh, yeah. Well, he was honest. He's like, yeah, we were looking for the Psycho Buster, but we couldn't find it because it was too dangerous. And they're like,
well, I think they were looking for the nuclear. They were looking for nukes.
Nukes, yeah. You're right. It was nukes. But he's like, but yeah, we couldn't find them. And he's like, you know, of course you want something to, because we don't want to be slaves forever. But I think that was, to me, that was a sign that he definitely, while he resents them, he still definitely was definitely more on their side, because the whole, we never saw it, but the whole battle with the Yakomaru versus Kiromaru's battalions basically were Kiromaru's entire army is wiped out by the Messiah, right? And so they're obviously not friends. And Yakomaru was basically trying to make it so that it was a one rat colony world, basically, right? He wanted to wipe them all out besides any that are loyal to him and his own. Because they even mimicked humans to the point where, you know, they have, like, Congress, and they basically lobotomized their queens to the point of just being birthing factories. Yeah, I'm like, wow, that was so messed up. Holy moly.
The biggest difference is that Kiromaru is still a royalist, I'd say, whereas Yakomaru has gone full-on, like, bloody revolutionary.
Yeah, like, it was... Akitomaru's only request, I think, was, please, you know, if anything, just please save my queen. And I was like, yeah, he's still. That's when I realized he's definitely still, like, air quotes, a good guy. I mean, and then you don't volunteer for a literal suicide mission, you know, that only really benefits your people that you intend to, like, betray. So I think he still realized that his sacrifice at the end was for the better of two evils, I guess, for lack of a better term.
Yeah, I kind of wonder if he was basically playing both sides up until that last moment, like deciding what he wanted to do, what side he wanted to back in the end.
I think that's entirely possible. Yeah, I think he was trying to see who was going to be the winner and then see if he can side with them. But then I think he realized that there's no way where he could let Squeeter win and he would still be okay. So I think he realized that this was just the only out, so to speak.
Yeah, Squeeter has proven himself to be so dishonest and willing to basically do anything that, yeah, if he won, he couldn't be trusted not to kill Kiromaru.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that was, he was one of my favorite characters, actually.
Easily one of them. I mean, he looked cool, like, giant monster samurai rat. I'm like, man, this is some, like, Warhammer stuff that I can get into. Like, I'm like, that's super rad. I wish, like, we saw more, like, of, like, the combat with the rats, because I thought there was some of the more interesting character designs. Like, they had so many different shapes and morphologies, so.
Mm-hmm. Although that was, when they did show the armies, it was that was all
the hideous
CG crowds.
Yeah. Yeah. Really bad. Which, CG.
I do want to give them a little bit of credit for their CG, because I think outside of the character CG, it was early enough on in CG and anime that they focused more on a kind of painterly, backgroundy style. Like, you could still tell it was CG just because of how it moved, but, like, I feel like most of the time it kind of worked, like what they had their, like, crafts and stuff. But then, yeah, once they went to characters, it was like, ugh, gross. I can't do this.
Oh, this is kind of getting into detail, like, the weird details. But one other thing I thought that was kind of weird, and it didn't affect me a ton because it was only for like half an episode. Was so when the rat assault happened, right, and everybody scattered, and they decided that, you know what, we're gonna have to have groups of five, and you guys go on patrols, and then Saki and Satoru go out with this group, and they run into that hospital with the gaping hole in it, and they're like, we're gonna investigate, and then you go in, and like you see people hung up like with spider webs.
Yeah, and that was weird.
Yeah, and you're led to believe, oh, it's some sort of weird spider monster. And then that wasn't it at all, because it turned out it was the air quotes ogre, which turned out to be just the, you know, the messiah, so to speak. But, like, what was the point of the spider web stuff? Like, I don't really see a point for that. Like, why were they kept alive, let alone, and where did the spider webs come from? Because there were no giant spiders.
Were those even spider webs? It looked like maybe they were wrapped up in all the bandages in the hospital or something.
I'd have to go back to lunch.
See, that's one of those things that I felt like... That's one of those things where I kind of felt like, oh, if this were in the novel, this would be like, there'd be a few words here and be like, oh, I totally understand this.
Yeah, I admit that part was kind of... I'm not totally sure what they were doing there. Like, when I initially watched it, I thought maybe they were trying to, like, psychologically torture them into becoming ogres or something, but when we learned that the ogre wasn't, then obviously that was out, so...
Well, actually, no, you know what? Now that you say that, I think that might have been what they were trying to do with that. I don't know, like, what was up with the weird cocoon thing, but based on their, like, the way they were acting afterwards, I wonder if...
I don't know, because what they indicated was that ogres are, like, an incredibly rare genetic mutation that occurs like once every handful of centuries. And so the odds of it, you know, like inducing it seem to be, this is me going into science, obviously, but like,
hang on. I think it's actually probably more common because they kill so many of their kids. So we don't actually know how often it is because they kill so many of them.
Yeah, that's true. That's a good point. It might be that less common, but they don't want to take a risk of letting, like, kids who are predisposed to being poor performers, and so they're going to end up being loners and potentially go down this potential path, because I guess they were not confident that it was either purely genetic or purely psychological. It was possibly a combination of the two, but they didn't want to roll the dice, because the last time they did, a lot of people died. And the only reason they were able to stop it was, frankly, dumb luck. So,
My reading of that was that it was half and half. Like, the death of shame itself was the genetic half, and then the other half, psychological, was the recognizing your shame. And that seems to be to me, that was the thing that could change, whereas that was why they needed all the conditioning and all that stuff as children, was to kind of make sure that was instilled properly. So it made sense to me that if you could break someone mentally, you could
potentially flip him into being an ogre.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, I think that's plausible, given the other rules set in the show. I will say the one thing I kind of did like was there were a decent amount of ground rules set in the show that were adhered to. So I do respect that part. Like, the whole scene part when the rat assault hop happened and people were, like, on edge, and some people accidentally, like, because they saw a shadow, they, like, ignite it, and there was other people, and then realized there was people, they died from the death of shame. I'm like, ooh, nice use of the rules there. Really brutal, but nice.
So,
the world building really was the thing that interested me most about the show. Because I haven't seen many, like, psionic apocalypse stories.
Yeah, agreed.
Yeah.
With that, so we get to the epilogue, and, you know, 36 or so, and they're supposed to have their first kid. Like, are they going to raise the kid up the same with all of the lies and deception about everything? And, you know,
it sounds like they don't want to, but it's hard to say how much they succeed or not, though.
I mean, it seems like Saki's parents didn't want to either, but they completely lied to her about everything forever.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, Saki's parents are worried because Saki was a late bloomer with her powers. And so if one didn't develop powers, they were automatically taken away.
Yeah, and they had already lost, what, at least two kids, one of whom we don't know about, if her name meant youngest of three or more?
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah, I thought that was interesting, too. Like, I did feel like at the end, nothing changed.
Yeah.
At all.
I agree with that. I definitely had the same feeling. I'm like, oh, so this is just, the world's exactly the same as it was before.
One thing, I guess, that we didn't even touch upon is a lot of one running, long running theme of this show, and is kind of never really heavily talked about, is like hypnosis is like basically constant, because when the kids first found that weird slug thing, I don't remember what they were called, they had a really weird name, that had the data, the library record, and then the
fake Minoshiro.
Yeah. And then the monk shows up and he sealed their powers, air quotes. But really, it was just a hypnotic suggestion. Even when this kid's, like, throw away the original powers on that big bonfire, it's basically a hypnotic suggestion. They're given, like, the trigger mantra to, like, unlock it, right? So, I thought that was another... Psychology is a big part of this whole... whole show, for sure. So, thought that was interesting. It kind of does this weird mix of psychology and pseudo real science, which I kind of got into. So,
yeah, I thought that was cool to kind of tie things together in that way. So we are coming up here at the end, so we should probably start to wrap up here. I don't know, you guys have any particular topics you wanted to mention or things that we didn't get to? How about starting with you, Mike?
I'm not sure I have anything off the top of my head. I'm not sure if anyone's managed to make it to this point without having watched the series yet. If so, sorry for all the spoilers, but consider watching it. It's an interesting watch, even if it can be a little slow.
Mm-hmm. Dylan, what about you?
When the show finally picks up and gets cool and interesting, they drop the great ending and go to a less good ending theme and less good ending animation. And that was super lame. I was very disappointed by that.
First ending is top tier. Second, pretty bad.
Yeah. Aside from that, the show had some really cool, had a couple really cool musical themes and good, really good usage of sound effects and cues throughout. Good production there, and things were, again, like, very well and consistent. And I think it's one of the things that it is from a novel, I'll call it light or whatever, I'll call it a serious novel, where someone put a lot of the thought into it, which does, I think that's the thing that has made the show where you're, like, even the parts where you're slow and kind of trying to force yourself through a couple eps at a time, you're still kind of like, huh, all right, there's still something here. It's interesting, even if things are being really super slow. So that's good.
How about you, Nick?
I think I've said my piece on it. Again, at the end of the day, I'm glad I watched it. Pretty interesting. Not a lot. Very, very difficult show to compare to anything else, really. Like, I wouldn't even know, if I'm trying to recommend this show to somebody, I wouldn't be able to ask, hey, what show did you like, so that I can know if I can compare it to that or not. Really?
Yeah.
Long time since I've seen a show that's this plotting and this slow in development, and I've actually enjoyed it by the end. So, but that being said, if you're into really interesting world setting without it all being handed to you on a silver platter, this could be a good pick, because part of me would really love to see what all happened that led up to the current society we see. But I think that's probably never going to happen, since it's been over 12 years now since the show aired.
It's also interesting how you can kind of see that the society has declined, or at least gotten more rural and less large scale over the course of the elder's life. Like, the flashback to that first ogre is obviously a much denser, more populated city.
Yeah, with, like, proper medicine with, like, syringes and stuff. That's literally the only reason why they were able to stop it. So,
yeah. Mm-hmm. And they do make a point at one point in the show of how even electricity is kind of restricted, like deliberately, where somebody's like, oh, hey, you know, things would be easier if I could get electricity out here, right? You have to, like, you know, talk to the committee or whatever about that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So it's interesting the other way they deliberately kind of devolved their society.
Deculture.
Yeah.
I think that part is because, sorry, the one last thing. I think that part is because the one thing that theoretically could stop telepaths is technology, so they technologized themselves as much as possible to keep the possibility of, you know, non-telepaths being able to actually develop weapons powerful enough to stop them. That's just my theory.
Oh, I see. Hmm. Now, that would make sense. I wish someone would translate the novel, although I did notice when looking to see if there was an English version of the novel that it has been fan translated, which is probably why there's no official English version. But we did get Crimson Labyrinth, which is kind of unfortunate. But yeah, I'm curious about the novel because I thinking more about it, I do feel like it probably would work better as a novel. Even though I still think the anime was pretty decent, and I'm sure a lot of people would really enjoy it a lot, the novel might be better.
Mm-hmm. One thing we can agree on, though, is it wouldn't have worked as a live-action drama unless it had much better effects than our typical.
You know what? Boy, this is maybe a topic for another podcast episode, but I've been thinking a lot about, like, what works for anime and what doesn't, especially when considering like the Netflix adaptations that have been going recently. but anyways, I'll leave that there. So with that, we will wrap up. Our next episode, we will be discussing, I believe, Streets of Fire. Is that it?
Yep.
The movie. Yeah. So, yes, the movie. And
yeah. A Hollywood movie, anywhere. No less.
Yes. A big inspiration for anime and creators in Japan. That's why we're watching it. You'll have to watch. If you want to watch it, you'll have to like rent it or buy it online. We can't find it streaming anywhere. And with that, too, I should mention that if you've got this far and you haven't watched Shin Sekaiori and you're still curious, you can watch it on Crunchyroll. Probably should have said that up front. Anyways, with that, this is AMO Kenzoku signing off. Saraba.